Catherine had seen some of these idiosyncrasies and had accepted them. Like Angela's aversion of physical contact by anyone other than Thomas, and her affliction to loud noises, and the way she could become transfixed by something her mind wouldn't stop working on, as had occurred tonight when she watched the reporter explaining that another woman had gone missing. She had been unable to concentrate on anything else for the rest of the evening. Despite her friendship with Catherine, Angela had never warmed to Catherine's husband, who was one of Thomas's closest friends. But this, too, seemed to be a non-issue for Catherine. They met frequently for lunch while their husbands worked.
"That was fun," Thomas said.
"Yeah."
"You and Catherine are becoming good friends?"
"We are. And her husband is nice, too." Thomas came over to her.
"Catherine's husband has a name, you know."
Angela averted her eyes, staring at her feet.
"I know tonight was hard for you, but you did great. I also know Catherine provides a level of comfort for you, but you can't only talk to her and me. You have to talk to everyone who's in the house. It's just polite."
She nodded.
"And you have to call people by their names. Bill, right? Catherine's husband's name is Bill."
"I know," Angela said. I'm not used to him, that's all."
"He's my business partner, and he's a good friend, so we're going to see him a lot."
"I'll work on it." He kissed her forehead again, like he had when she watched the reporter covering the latest disappearance, and went back to the dishes. "I'm dropping this outside," Angela said, lifting the tied-off garbage bag. She headed out the kitchen door, which led to the backyard. She walked across the small plot of grass and noticed the utility door to the garage was open. It was dark now, and light spilled from the garage and through the door frame to form a trapezoid on the grass outside the door. When Thomas was grilling the chicken, Angela remembered Catherine's husband, Bill, as Thomas had just reminded her, walking freely in and out of the garage. It was another part of the night that made her uneasy, knowing the garage was a mess of clutter and junk. Angela had a hard time with things that were not strictly organized, and she was so embarrassed by the appearance of the garage that she had considered closing the door at one point during the evening as a non-verbal way of asking Catherine's husband to stay on the patio. Angela shut the utility door now and pushed past the chain-link fence to enter the darkened alley. Lifting the top of the trash can, she placed the garbage bag into the empty bin. A cat hissed and darted from behind the cans. Startled, she dropped the trash can top, causing a loud metallic ruckus to echo through the alley while she let out a scream. Dogs barked from adjacent lots. Angela took a deep breath and looked down the alley. A street light glowed at the far end of the block, casting swaying shadows of tree limbs onto the ground. In her mind, Angela pictured a satellite image of the city limits, and referenced her location now as she stood in the shadowed alley on the far fringes of the city. Angela's thoughts turned to the diagram she had meticulously created, in which she placed red dots to mark the suspected location of each abducted woman. She had highlighted in bright yellow the area that joined them all. Her neighborhood was far outside the colored pentagon. With a rumble in her chest and a tremor in her hands, Angela retrieved the top of the trash can and haphazardly threw it back in place before running through the yard and into her kitchen. Thomas had finished the dishes and she heard the Cubs game playing in the living room. When she peeked in on him, Thomas was in a deep recline in the Lazy Boy, which meant he'd soon be snoring. With her fingertips alive with adrenaline, she snuck into her bedroom and knelt at the foot of the bed. Opening the trunk, she found the stack of newspaper clippings and her map of the city. She'd spent the entire evening suppressing her obsessive-compulsive needs. Angela's freshly learned self-restraint had done her well. It opened up a new world with Thomas and had allowed her to forge a friendship with Catherine. But Angela knew she could not completely ignore the needs of her mind and the demands of her central nervous system, which screamed for her to organize and list and break down the things that made no sense.
She saw things as either straight and ordered with sharp 90-degree angles or in complete disarray. The calls of her mind to piece together in rigid order anything that did not line up smoothly had always been loud and impossible to ignore. But lately, those screams had been deafening. The idea that there was a man who had eluded the police, who had thrown the city into a state of paralysis, was the very definition of chaos. And ever since Angela had allowed her fierce and unrelenting psyche to consider this man, whom the authorities called the thief, she had been able to think of nothing else. She brought her stack of newspaper articles to the small desk in her bedroom, clicked on the light, and spread them out in front of her. Angela read them all for the 100th time, determined to find what everyone else had missed. Chicago, August 1979. Angela spent the following morning at her kitchen table, surrounded by the previous week's newspaper clippings about the thief. She had read them late into the night as Thomas slept on the Lazy Boy. Now he had left for work, and Angela was back at it. Both the Tribune and the Sun-Times lay before her, as she meticulously worked the scissors around the corners of each article. She'd even managed to score a New York Times that had a brief write-up about the events in Chicago, the article drawing parallels to the Son of Sam killings from 3 years earlier. Angela read and reread the news pieces, concentrating on the 5 women who had gone missing, and cataloging everything that had been reported about each victim. She collected photos and created her own biographies. She knew so much about each woman that she felt connected to them. Angela worked hard to hide from Thomas the full scale of her affliction. There had been stretches in the past when her obsessive-compulsive disorder had consumed her, overwhelming her mind in ways that prevented routine rituals of daily life. During the darkest times, the illness tethered Angela to the completion of redundant tasks her brain insisted were necessary. And the more she tried to break free from those tumultuous duties, the more paranoid she became that something terrible would happen if she interrupted the cycle of meaningless assignments. The loop of paranoia fed itself until Angela was lost to its power. She felt that pull happening again now, and knew she needed to tame this current bout of obsession if she hoped to avoid a relapse. But she felt helpless when her mind focused on the missing women and the anonymous man who was taking them. Angela believed she could find a link between the victims. What she would do with her discovery, Angela hadn't decided. Perhaps she would share her findings with the authorities. But Angela was careful not to get too far ahead of herself. Thinking too far into the future opened her mind to wild speculation that caused angst and fear. If Thomas noticed her missing lashes and thinning eyebrows again, he'd worry about a relapse. This would send her back to her therapist's office, which would spell the end to her research. She couldn't let that happen. The women who stared back from the newspaper clippings deserved her attention, and Angela was powerless to ignore them. After the press clippings were cataloged and ordered, she packed up her files and placed them back in the chest at the foot of her bed. It was 10 o'clock a.m. when she brought her coffee out to the garage. She carried with her 2 homemade breakfast sandwiches wrapped in foil. The garage was a detached 2-car unit behind their bungalow-style home. A cement walkway led from the patio off the kitchen and ran to the utility door at the back of the garage, the front of which opened into the alley. The previous night, Angela had allowed her imagination to create irrational nightmares of what waited in the dark shadows after the cat ran from behind the trash cans. This morning, the sun was bright and her fear was gone. She walked through the utility door and hit the opener on the wall, causing the large garage door to rattle upward and allowing the morning sun to brighten the area. Because she rarely ventured into the garage, it was incongruent to the home she kept. If the space were hers and not Thomas's, Angela would have it ordered and meticulous the way everything else in her life needed to be. Instead, it was a mess of cluttered shelving filled with tattered books and dusty storage containers. There were paint cans coated with the drippings of a home project from when she and Thomas had painted the bedroom, There was car repair equipment, which Thomas had stacked in the corner, and an old couch they had meant to sell but had never gotten around to. The couch was now filthy from dust and dirt and covered by old magazines and newspapers. It was her morning project. Wednesday was garbage day, and Angela's task was to drag the old couch into the alley for the garbage men to haul away. The breakfast sandwiches were her bribe to the guys for hauling away such a large piece of trash. Before she could get to the couch, though, Angela started with the magazines and newspapers that covered it, dumping them in the trash. After 10 minutes, the couch was empty of the clutter that had covered it. Positioning herself near the entrance of the garage, she grasped the arm of the couch and pulled. It was weighty, and her progress was slow. But after 10 minutes, Angela managed to drag the couch into the alley. She needed to move it another 20 feet to the garbage area, but she had spent her strength hauling the heavy piece of furniture this far. She walked into the garage to catch her breath and regain her energy. As she took deep, recovering breaths, she looked anxiously at the cluttered shelves, knowing that Thomas would be upset if she took her obsessiveness for order to the rest of the garage, when she had told him she planned only to move the couch out to the garbage. But her fingers tingled as she looked at the chaotic shelving. Inspecting the items, she found things she had forgotten existed. Old glassware from before she had married, and holiday decorations she and Thomas had never used. On another set of shelves, Angela stumbled over old wedding gifts that were both impractical and unwanted. She found a picnic basket flanked on each side with compartments for wine bottles. Never in her life had she been on a picnic, and the idea of sipping wine while sitting among insect-infested grass caused her skin to crawl. She lifted the top of the basket. Something inside caught her eye. A closer inspection revealed a thin jewelry box. She looked around the garage and then out into the alley, as if she had just discovered a hidden treasure and worried about another learning her secret. She pulled the box from the depths of the basket and opened it. A sliver of morning sunlight slanted through the side window of the garage and struck the diamonds of the necklace, brilliantly highlighting the green peridot they encircled. It wasn't unusual for Thomas to make extravagant purchases. He'd done so in the past, and Angela's birthday was just a week away. She immediately felt guilty for having spoiled his surprise.
"Can I offer you a hand?"
The deep, unfamiliar voice caused Angela to jump. She dropped the necklace back into the basket and spun around, finding herself face to face with a man she did not know. Her lungs expanded in an unintentional gasp, and a whine escaped into the air. The man stood in the alley by the couch, but his presence felt much closer. He had deep-set eyes darkened by the morning light, which shined down from behind him and silhouetted his form. The black presence of his shadow crept across the garage floor, coming so close to Angela that her skin tingled with goosebumps.
"Looks like you're stalled."
"No, no," Angela said without thought. She was backing away toward the utility door behind her, her feet staggering. As a general rule, Angela Mitchell avoided eye contact whenever possible, but the charcoal holes in the man's face were too cryptic to ignore.
"I'll just give it a push with you,"
the man said.
"Help you get it over to the trash cans. You're throwing it away, yes?"
Angela shook her head. Her mind flashed to the biography she had amassed on the missing women, the newspaper articles she had scanned and studied, the map of the city she had marked with the locations of the disappearances, and the bright yellow pentagon she had highlighted to demark the area of the city to avoid. She was filled now with the same sense of dread as when the stray cat had hissed from behind the trash cans. Last night she had sensed another's presence, and she had run back into the house before her mind could dwell too heavily on the feeling. And since then, Angela had worked hard to compartmentalize the thought, to suppress the idea that someone had been present with her in the alley, watching from the shadows. To allow her mind to concentrate on that fear, to permit her psyche to continuously strike the flint that might throw sparks onto the tinder of her anxiety, had the power to drive her mad. Once that thought was ignited, she would be unable to stifle the flames. Years before, a vagrant thought like that could send her into a weeks-long state of paranoia and obsessiveness, where she'd lock herself in her home, checking and double-checking the door locks, climbing from bed in the dark of night to make sure every window was secure, lifting the phone 100 times in a row to make sure a dial tone was present to prove it was functional. Angela had worked too hard over the last few years to allow her new life to be ruined by the inner workings of her convoluted mind. But now, as she stared at the man in the alley, she wished she'd paid closer attention to the warnings her brain had sent last night. "My husband will be right out," she managed to say. "He'll help me the rest of the way." The man looked beyond Angela, through the frame of the open utility door behind her and to the back of the bungalow. He pointed at the house.
"Your husband is home?"
"Yes," Angela said too quickly. The man took a step forward to the precipice of the garage, bringing his murky shadow closer until it bent off the floor and climbed up her legs. Angela could almost feel it.
"You sure I can't help?"
Angela backed farther away. She turned and hurried through the utility door and into the backyard. She ran to the kitchen door and fumbled with the handle until she pulled the door open and stepped into the safety of her home, immediately locking the door behind her. She peeled the curtains to the side to peek outside. The man stood next to the abandoned couch, staring through the open garage door at the back of Angela's house. Over the pounding in her ears, the squeaking brakes of the garbage truck broke through as it turned into the alley. The stranger looked behind him and hurried away as the truck approached. Angela's hands were shaking. She couldn't bring herself to go back outside to talk with the garbage men, to deliver the sandwiches in exchange for them taking the couch. Instead, she ran to the bathroom, lifted the lid to the toilet, and vomited until her eyes teared and her sternum ached. Chapter 6. Chicago, October 16th, 2019. Rory Moore pulled next to the unmarked squad car, driver's side to driver's side. She rolled down her window and pushed her non-prescription glasses up the bridge of her nose. It was dark and shadowed inside her car. She was sure Detective Davidson couldn't see her eyes, always a plus. The detective handed her a manila envelope through the window.
"Autopsy and tox results," he said. "Plus all the notes and interviews taken on the case."
Rory took the package, saw Camille Bird's name printed on the bottom of the folder, and thought of the girl's shattered Kestner doll and her father's pleas for help. Rory dropped the file on the passenger seat.
"You're officially on the case," Ron said. "I filled out the paperwork this morning."
"When was the last time any of your guys looked at any of this?" Rory asked. Davidson ballooned his cheeks as he exhaled a defeated breath. Rory knew he was embarrassed by the answer he was about to offer.
"It's over a year old, with nothing new in months and over 500 new homicides so far this year. It's cold."
Rory's mind flashed back to the morning in Grant Park, when Ron had shown her where Camille's frozen body had been found. Rory's heart ached, the way it did for the victim of every case she took on. It was why she was so selective. Within the tiny world of forensic reconstruction, no one could do what Rory Moore routinely accomplished. She had breathed fresh life into cases that were colder than a Chicago winter. It was simply in her genes. Her DNA was programmed to see things others missed, to connect dots that looked scattered and incongruent to everyone else. She left the straightforward reconstructions, the car wrecks and suicides, to others in her profession who were better suited to handle such trivial cases, the ones detectives could figure out on their own with a little effort and a lucky break. Those clinical cases never challenged Rory. She reconstructed cold case homicides, cases others had abandoned and given up on. But she accomplished this by developing a deep and personal connection with the victim. She accomplished this by learning their story, discovering first who they were. Why they were killed always followed. It was a taxing technique that drained her emotionally and often brought her closer to the victim for whom she was seeking justice than she was to anyone else in her life. But it was the only way Rory knew how to do her job. Rory knew that Ron Davidson, who ran the homicide division inside the Chicago Police Department, was under pressure from every direction, political and social, to pull Chicago's unsolved murder rate out of the toilet. The city had one of the nation's lowest homicide solve rates. So when Rory agreed to take on Camille Byrd's icy cold unsolved homicide, it represented an opportunity for Ron to knock a case off his docket without expending many resources. Rory reconstructed crimes on her own, rebuffing assistance from any of the homicide detectives. For years, the force had kept Rory on retainer, and if she weren't so selective about the cases she took on, she'd have a new one every week. "I'll take a look and let you know what I find," Rory finally said.
"Keep me posted."
Rory's window began its ascent.
"Hey, Gray," Davidson said.
Rory stopped the window halfway up, looked through the glass at him.
"Sorry about your dad."
Rory nodded and started the window back up, before the two cars drove off in opposite directions. Chapter 7. Chicago, October 16th, 2019. Rory walked into the nursing home and entered room 121. The lights were dim, and the television cast the room in a blue glow. A woman lay still in the bed, her eyes open but not acknowledging Rory's presence. Rory approached the hospital bed, which sported tall guardrails on either side to protect its occupant. She sat in the adjacent chair and looked at the woman, who continued to stare at the television as if Rory were invisible. She reached out and took the woman's hand. "Aunt Greta. It's me, Rory." Her great aunt inverted her lips, sucking them into her mouth the way she did after the nurses had removed her dentures.
"Greta," Rory said in a whispered voice. "Can you hear me?"
"I tried to save you," the old woman said.
"I tried, but there was too much blood."
"Okay," Rory said. "It's okay."
"You were bleeding."
Her great aunt looked at Rory.
"There was too much blood."
A nurse walked into the room. "Sorry, I tried to catch you before you came in. She's having a bad day." The nurse adjusted the pillows behind Greta's head, placed a white styrofoam cup with a straw extending out of it on the overbed table.
"Here's your water, hon. And there's no blood around here. I hate blood. That's why I work in this place."
"How long has she been like this?" The nurse looked at Rory.
"Most of the day. She was fine yesterday. But as you know, dementia takes them back to another part of their life. Sometimes just briefly, other times for much longer. It'll pass."
Rory nodded, pointed at the styrofoam. "I'll get her to drink." The nurse smiled.
"Call me if you need anything."
As soon as the nurse was gone, Rory's great aunt looked at her again.
"I tried to save you. There was too much blood."
Greta had been a nurse, and though it had been many years since she practiced, the dementia, which was ravaging her mind, pulled her back to the darkest moments of her profession. Greta went silent and looked back at the television. Rory knew it would be one of those visits. Her great aunt was 92 years old, and her mental capacity varied widely. Sometimes she was as sharp as ever. Other times, like tonight and over the past 2 weeks since Greta had learned about the passing of Rory's father, she was lost in the past, in a world that Rory could not penetrate. The best chance over the last several years to catch her in a coherent state came at night. Sometimes Rory came and went in a matter of minutes. Other times, when Aunt Greta was alert and talkative, Rory stayed into the early hours of morning, talking and laughing like she remembered doing as a child. Few people fully understood Rory Moore. Her great-aunt Greta was one of them. "Greta, do you remember what I told you about Dad? About Frank, your nephew?" Greta chewed some more on her capsized lips. "The funeral was last week. I tried to bring you, but you weren't feeling well." Rory saw her great-aunt's chewing grow faster. "You didn't miss anything, except me squirming in the corner trying to avoid everyone. I could have used you for cover, old lady." This brought a quick glance from Greta and the subtle twitch of a smile. Rory knew she had broken through on a night that had offered little opportunity. What better way to deflect attention from myself than to wheel in a little old lady everyone loves? Rory felt her great-aunt squeeze her hand. A tear formed on Greta's eyelid and then rolled down her cheek. Rory stood and quickly pulled a tissue from the box to wipe Greta's face. "Hey," she said, trying for the eye contact she normally worked to avoid. "I've got a tough one I need your help with. It's a Kestener doll with a bad fracture through the left eye socket. I can fix the break, but I might need some help with the coloring. The porcelain is faded, and I'll need to color over the epoxy. You want to lend a hand?" Greta looked at Rory. She stopped chewing her lips. Then she nodded with a subtle bob of her head. "Good," Rory said. "You're the best. And you taught me everything I know. I'll bring your colors and brushes next time I visit, and you can take a look." Rory sat back down in the bedside chair, reached for Greta's hand again, and spent an hour watching the muted television screen until she was sure her great aunt had drifted off to sleep. Chapter 8. Chicago, October 16th, 2019. She pulled to the front of her bungalow and parked on the street, which was lined with her neighbors' cars. It was just past 11 o'clock, and Rory felt good about her visit with Greta. She didn't always feel that way when she left her great-aunt's side. Alzheimer's and dementia had stolen most of her personality, turning her at times into a nasty old woman who could spit insults like a drunken sailor one moment and babble incoherently the next. Despite the ferocity of the abuse, the vile version of Aunt Greta was preferred to the vacant-eyed, hollow soul Rory often found when she visited. Each of Greta's personalities was tolerated, because occasionally, like tonight, there was a glimpse of the woman Rory had loved her whole life. It had been a good night. The dog across the street barked as Rory walked up her steps and keyed the front door, grabbing the mail on her way in. She dumped the stack of envelopes, along with Camille Bird's autopsy report, onto her kitchen table and pulled a glass from the cabinet. The middle shelf of her refrigerator held 6 bottles of Three Floyds Dark Lord, an impossible-to-find imperial stout that Rory managed to keep well-stocked through an Indiana connection. Each 22-ounce bottle was positioned label out and in flawless rows, the only way Dark Lord should be shelved. She plucked one from the front, popped the cap, poured it into the tall glass, and topped it off with black currant cordial. With an alcohol content of 15%, the beer was stronger than most wines, and it took only a couple of glasses to obtain the desired effect. At the kitchen table, she pushed the stack of mail to the side and pulled the manila envelope she had received from Detective Davidson in front of her. 2 full swallows of stout and a deep breath. Then she dove in, opening the file to the first page of the autopsy report. At the time of her death, Camille Bird was a 22-year-old recent University of Illinois graduate. She'd finished college in May and was still hunting for a place to put her communications major to use. She lived in Wicker Park with 2 roommates. The medical examiner determined the cause of death to be throttling or manual strangulation. Manner of death: homicide. No evidence of sexual assault.
Two more swallows of stout, and Rory turned the page. She read through the Emmy's findings. Classic signs of asphyxiation were noted. Blood-stained fluid in the airway, swelling of the lungs, petechia on the face, and subconjunctival hemorrhage in the eyes. Severe bruising was noted to Camille's neck, along with fractures to the hyoid bone and larynx, confirming the conclusion of strangulation. The presence of fingerprint markings left no doubt. Rory pulled an autopsy photo in front of her. She reread the findings. Camille Bird had gone missing one night, and her body was discovered the next. Rigor mortis and lividity allowed the time of death to be gauged at 24 hours prior to her body being discovered. Whoever killed Camille Bird had done it quickly. Leukotriene B4 was detected in skin samples, Rory read, indicating that the bruising on the neck took place antemortem, before the girl had died, and now present forevermore as the healing power of her body faded with her last breath. She spent an hour in her quiet house, flipping through the rest of the medical examiner's report, before she switched to the detective's notes. The autopsy report had been computer-generated. The homicide division of the Chicago PD still worked with paper charts. Opening the file brought an assault of ugly, curt penmanship that was difficult to decipher. Rory was certain of some Freudian link between male detectives' atrocious penmanship and their mother's, as if their childish writing was evidence of a man's constant need for pampering. For an hour, and over another dark lord spiked with black currant cordial, Rory read about the life of Camille Bird. From her childhood to the day she went missing, to the morning her frozen body was found in Grant Park. She took notes, single-spaced, one sentence after the other, until she filled an entire page. Unlike the detective's writing, Rory's was perfect cursive. However, with no spaces between sentences and few punctuation marks, she was sure her notes looked nearly as indecipherable as the detective's piggish scribble. When she closed the file, Rory knew she was a long way from knowing Camille Bird as well as would be necessary to find the answers she was looking for. But tonight was a start. Stacking the reports to the side, Rory finally closed her eyes. She settled her mind and allowed the facts to take hold. That night, she would dream of Camille Bird, the way she always dreamt of victims she studied. This was how every reconstruction began. She chose each case carefully and devoted her full attention to it until she reached her conclusion and turned everything over to the detectives to finish the job. After 20 minutes of meditation, she opened her eyes and took a deep breath. She carried the files into her office and placed them neatly on her desk, removed the 8x10 photograph of Camille Bird, and pinned it to the large corkboard on the wall. Pocked with holes from previous reconstructions, the board had told many disturbing stories over the years. Tonight, the echoes from previous cases went unheard as Rory stared at the photo of Camille Bird, who stared back from some unearthly place, waiting for Rory's help. She hit the lights on the way out of the office. With the rest of the house dark, she grabbed another beer from the fridge and headed to the den. The room contained only indirect lighting, no overhead bulbs or lamps, just carefully positioned spotlights. The first switch Rory tripped brought to life the built-in shelves and silhouetted 2 dozen antique china dolls that stood on the ledges. Positioned 3 per shelf and in seamless columns, the recessed lighting cast each doll in a perfect combination of luminance and shadow. Every doll's porcelain face shined under the spell of the lighting, both the coloring and the polish flawless. Exactly 24 dolls stood on the shelves. Any less left a vacancy that gnawed at Rory until the empty slot was filled. She'd tried it before, removing one doll without replacing it with another. The unfilled space created an imbalance in her mind that prevented sleep and work and rational thought. The nagging annoyance dissipated, Rory had discovered, only after she filled the vacancy with another doll to make the shelving complete.
She'd come to terms with this affliction years ago and had finally stopped battling it. It had been embedded in her since she was a young child standing in Aunt Greta's house staring at doll-lined shelves. Rory's love of restoration originated during her formative years, when she spent her summers with Greta bringing broken dolls back to perfection. Now Rory's den had looked the same for more than a decade, and was a replica of Aunt Greta's house from years ago, the built-ins lined with some of her most triumphant restorations, never a vacancy present. A thin drawer was positioned under each shelf, in which rested before pictures of each doll featured on the ledge above. The 8x10 glossy photos depicted cracked faces, missing eyes, jagged tears that spilled white stuffing, stained garments, missing limbs, and faded porcelain that had shed its glaze over years of life. The images in the drawers stood in stark contrast to the immaculate dolls standing on the shelves above, which Rory had meticulously brought back to life. Sitting at her workbench, she turned on her gooseneck lamp and directed its beam to the ruined Kestner doll Camille Bird's father had used to lure Rory into reconstructing his daughter's death. She took another sip of Dark Lord and began her cursory examination, photographing the damaged doll from every angle until finally laying it flat and taking a conclusive picture that would become the before image against which her restoration would be gauged. The beer buzz, coupled with the preoccupation of a new project, both Camille Bird's childhood doll and the woman herself, was enough to penetrate the deep folds of Rory's brain and distract her from the gnawing image of the files waiting for resolution in her father's law office. The distraction of a new project was just sufficient to push into the shadows of her mind the thought of her father dying alone in his home. Chapter 9. Stateville Correctional Center, October 17, 2019. His killing spree decades ago had, for a short time, made him a celebrity. But soon after his conviction, the world moved on and had mostly forgotten about the thief. Only in recent months had his star begun to rise again, as journalists relived the summer of 1979 by recounting the women who had been informally counted as his victims. Family members were tracked down. Friends, now gray and wrinkled by age, spoke of long-forgotten kinships with those they lost. Ambitious newscasters replayed old footage in an attempt to recapture the panic of the city during that sweltering summer when the thief ran loose through the shadowed streets of Chicago, stealing young women never to be seen again. And now, as his celebrity began its slow ascent, he would need to rely on the one man who had helped him most over the years. He had access to the prison email system, but it was a tedious process to receive and deliver messages, and prison rules placed strict word counts on his emails. It was faster and easier to write his letters by hand and send them through the post office, which he had done several times in the last 3 weeks without a response. The United States Postal Service, jail mail, had always been his swiftest form of communication. Faster even than a phone call, which required him to make a formal request, wait for approval, and then schedule a date and time to use the prison payphone. It had always been his preference when he needed to get a hold of his attorney to simply pen a letter, stuff it in an envelope, and drop it in the mail. But after 2 weeks without a reply, he decided to petition for a phone call. With his final parole board hearing fast approaching, his attorney had been in constant contact with him regarding the details of his impending release. But for the last 2 weeks, his attorney had been silent and unreachable. The thief lay on his bunk now and folded his hands across his chest as he waited. There was an imbalance in the universe. He could feel it in his gut. Passing time had never been a challenge, at least not for many years. But of late, since the parole board had stamped him with approved, time became something more difficult to manage. His sentence was coming to an end,
and he allowed himself to taste what waited on the outside. It was a dangerous practice to entertain thoughts about the freedoms that might soon come to him. It was especially dangerous to imagine the satisfaction of finding her. Still, despite the hazards, he closed his eyes as he lay on his bunk and imagined finally coming face to face with her. What a joyous moment it would be. The woman who had put him here would finally receive retribution.
"Orsix," the guard said, interrupting his thoughts. "You got phone privileges today?"
He sat up quickly and stood from his bed.
"Yes, sir."
The guard turned his head and, in a booming voice, yelled down the length of the cell block.
12276-5946.
His voice echoed off the walls and conjured prisoners to the front of their cells, where they stuck their arms through the bars and rested their elbows on the metal as they watched what was transpiring. 4-6's cell door rattled open, and the guard motioned for him to take the lead as they walked down the long galley. Seeing nothing exciting, the other prisoners melted back into their cells. A door buzzed as they approached the end of the gangplank, and 4-6 pushed through it. Another guard was waiting for him on the other side. He did a quick pat down, and then motioned him toward an isolated payphone on the wall. 4-6 went through the practiced routine of navigating the automated prison phone system that allowed outgoing collect calls, dialed the number from memory, and listened to the staticky ring through the receiver. After the 8th loop of buzzing, the call went to voicemail, where he learned that his attorney's mailbox was full. The universe was off. Something was wrong. All of his fantasies about finding her began to fade. Chicago, August 1979. The vomiting continued for the entire week after her encounter with the stranger in the alley. Her head swam with vertigo, and her stomach roiled with nausea every time Angela thought of that morning. The dirty couch had sat abandoned for the entire day. The garbage men hadn't touched it. The couch sat at an odd angle at the precipice of the open garage door, and Angela imagined they assumed it was there temporarily while the garage was being cleaned. She had watched through the slit in the curtain that covered the kitchen window as the garbage truck stopped in the alley, and the guys emptied her overflowing trash cans into the back of the truck before hopping back onto the fender as the driver continued down the alley. Angela couldn't bring herself to open the kitchen door and run to the alley to ask them to haul the couch away. It was early afternoon when Angela had heard the honking that day. Her neighbor was attempting to pull his car into the garage directly across from Angela's, but couldn't make it past the couch to cut the tight angle. As was typical in Chicago, the constant honking of one's horn was the chosen solution to nearly every problem a driver faced, from slow-moving traffic to kids playing ball in the street to a deserted couch in an alley. When the honking reached 5 nerve-wracking minutes, Angela had finally gotten up the nerve to leave the house. She pulled the couch back into the garage, shut the door, and hurried back inside to bolt the door behind her. Once, twice, 3 times to be sure. She told Thomas about the day's adventure as soon as he'd gotten home. He suggested they call the police, but when they discussed it further, Angela was at a loss for exactly what she would be reporting. That a stranger and likely a neighbor had been kind enough to offer his assistance? That a cat had frightened her the night before and filled her with the sense that she was being watched? Angela knew how that conversation would go. She could already see the sideways glances the officers would give each other while Angela stuttered through her explanation, all the time doing her best to avoid eye contact. The nervous plucking of her eyebrows would be looked upon like a contagious disease until the officers excused themselves to speak with Thomas in private about his paranoid wife, who was clearly making more out of things than was there. The further she discussed the incident with Thomas, the more absurd it sounded to call the police. More pressing now, a week later, was Angela's fear that she was on the verge of an obsessive-compulsive breakdown, that she even recognized its imminent approach, like thunderclouds on the horizon, could be considered progress.
Years before, the affliction would descend upon her without warning, to steal a week or a month as the demands of her mind sent her on meaningless tasks of redundancy. But in the new paradigm of her life, Angela not only sensed the collapse approaching, she fought like hell to prevent it. While she battled her condition, she also worked hard to hide the worst of her symptoms from Thomas. The lack of eyelashes was camouflaged by a thick application of mascara to the few follicles that remained, and a shadowing pencil bolstered her thinning eyebrows. Despite the sweltering heat, Angela had taken to wearing jeans and long shirts in lieu of shorts and tank tops in order to hide the bloody scabs that marked her shoulders and thighs from her nervous scratching. The masking of her symptoms, however, was a venomous crutch that made things worse. The better Angela was able to conceal her habits of self-mutilation, the more dramatic her dependency on them became. She tried to stop herself with subtle tricks that had worked in the past. She kept the tips of her fingers slick with Vaseline to make more difficult the grasping of her eyebrow follicles. And she clipped her nails down to the soft pads of her fingers to make them benign tools as she dug into her skin. She was managing thus far to keep the worst of her breakdown hidden. The vomiting, however, was becoming a problem. Thomas noticed it the other morning. When he checked on her, Angela had told him it was the result of bad Chinese food. In reality, the nausea came every time she worked herself into a frenzy with thoughts of the stranger from the alley. Each morning after Thomas left for work, Angela spent hours pulling the curtains of the kitchen door to the side so she could stare out into the alley. A routine developed. Pull curtain, check alley, secure lock, lift phone, listen for dial tone, repeat. The only thing that broke the cycle was the need to vomit. Her stomach turned whenever the image popped into her mind of the man standing in the alley and peering through the open garage door and into her kitchen, which sent her to the bathroom in violent flurries of retching. It was during a rare moment of lucidity a week after her encounter in the alley when Angela had discovered an expired bottle of Valium from her previous doctor. Swallowing a tablet every 6 hours, Angela found, took the edge off, allowed her to sleep at night, and brought her mind back from the encounter in the garage. It was a temporary fix until she could reason with herself and calm her mind. She had beaten the obsessiveness before. She could do it again. Under the calming effects of the Valium, Angela convinced herself that it was possible and even likely that her encounter in the alley was nothing more than a good Samaritan offering his help. And it was very unlikely that the horror of the missing women could stretch this far out to the fringe of the city limits, where she lived a quiet life. She took a deep breath and tried to steady her shaking fingers as she poured her morning coffee. She stopped her gaze before she could look for the 100th time out the back window and into the alley. Instead, she forced her thoughts to focus on the missing women and the profiles she had created. It had been days since she thought of them. She retrieved the press clippings from the chest in her bedroom and spread them across the kitchen table. For 2 hours, Angela studied the missing women and the notes she had made about each of them. Perhaps it was the clean slate of her mind coming off a lost week of paranoia, or the Valium freeing her thoughts to flow in ways they hadn't in the weeks before. But as she read through the profiles, she saw something she had missed previously. Her mind ran through the cataloged information, like scrolling through microfilm at the library. Articles she had read over the past year suddenly came together in her mind, and she saw a pattern that had always been there, waiting to be discovered, but to this point had gone unnoticed. Her mind raced, and she jotted notes, but the bleached-out exertion from fighting her OCD for the last week had frayed her neurons and brought self-doubt. Surely she was wrong. Pushing her insecurities aside, Angela scribbled notes frantically as thoughts spilled from her mind, fearful that if she didn't capture them on the page, they'd be lost forever. She recalled with great clarity the newspaper articles she had read years earlier, and scribbled names and dates from the images that sped through her mind. When she finished, she looked at the clock.
It was approaching the noon hour. She had sat down at the kitchen table 3 hours ago, but it felt like only minutes. Quickly dressing in jeans and a long-sleeved shirt, Angela stuffed her notes into her purse. A wave of nausea came over her as she imagined leaving the house, but she had no choice. She had to get to the library to confirm her suspicions. She knew, too, she would have to take another precaution. She needed confirmation that her thoughts were lucid and coherent, and not the result of her paranoia. And that confirmation could come from only one person. Angela picked up the phone and dialed her friend Catherine's number.
Hello?
Catherine, Angela said in a soft voice.
Angela?
Yes, it's me.
Are you feeling better? Thomas told Bill that you've been ill since the night we had dinner together.
Perhaps, Angela considered, she hadn't been hiding her symptoms as well as she imagined. I'm fine, but I need to talk with you. Can we meet?
Sure. Is something wrong?
No. I just need some help. Can I stop by in a while?
Of course, Catherine said.
Angela hung up without saying goodbye, ran to the bathroom, and then vomited. Chicago, August 1979. Angela Mitchell spent 2 hours among the library shelves, pulling books and skimming pages. She sat at the microfilm station and spun old rolls of newspaper articles that dated back to the summer of 1970, nearly a decade earlier. She scribbled notes until her uncanny mind saw clearly the pattern she suspected existed. She spent 30 minutes plotting her findings onto graph paper and creating a line chart that translated her findings to paper form so others might understand her discovery. She organized her notes, returned the microfilm to the shelf, and hurried from the library. Catherine's house was just 2 blocks from her own, and at 3 o'clock p.m., Angela pushed through the wrought iron gate that led to the front stoop. Even before Angela could knock, Catherine opened the door.
"Woman, it's 90 degrees outside," Catherine said as Angela walked up the front steps. "Why are you covered in denim?"
Angela looked at her jeans and button-down shirt. She was less concerned with how her fashion choices would react to the sweltering heat, as she was with hiding the scabbed-over claw marks that covered her arms and legs. "I'm behind on laundry," she finally said.
"Come into the air conditioning."
Catherine pushed open the screen door and waved Angela inside. They sat at the kitchen table.
"So, what got you so sick? Stomach bug?"
"Yes," Angela said, glancing quickly into Catherine's eyes, her first bit of eye contact, then back down to the table. "But I've been over it for the last few days. You know how Thomas worries." Thomas had pushed hard during the first year or two of marriage for Angela to mix with his friends' wives, but Angela had always felt judged by them. They whispered about her when they thought she wasn't listening, and treated her like a child when she didn't respond to their boisterous ways. Catherine Blackwell was different. Angela felt accepted when she was with Catherine, who never asked foolish questions or gave confused looks when Angela grew quiet with anxiety. Catherine had always made her feel comfortable and stood by her whenever anyone treated Angela badly. The first time the two ventured to lunch together, a condescending waitress had scolded Angela for not speaking loudly enough.
"Speak up, honey."
"Her name is Angela, not honey," Catherine had said. "And she's almost 30 years old, not 12. From that moment, Catherine Blackwell was not only her protector, she was Angela Mitchell's closest friend.
"Can I get you something to drink?"
"No, no," Angela said. "Thanks, though."
"So, what's so urgent?"
"I know this is going to sound crazy," Angela said, pulling a folder from her purse. It held newspaper clippings and her biographies of the missing women, in addition to the reams of paper from her latest research trip to the library.
"But I've been looking into the women who have gone missing."
This caught Catherine's attention.
"Looking into them how?"
"I've been collecting bits of information about them from the papers and from newscasts."
Catherine pulled one of the pages across the table. It was a Chicago Tribune article about Samantha Rogers, the latest girl who had disappeared from the streets of Chicago. Catherine had watched one of the news reports about the missing girl with Angela when they all had dinner together the week before. The girl's picture was at the top of the article, a crease bent through her photo, where the clipping had been folded and stashed in Angela's binder.
"Why are you collecting all this?" Catherine asked.
Angela looked up. Angela caught herself. Speaking the word obsessed out loud would be confessing to her friend the dark affliction that had plagued her life. It was unlikely, Angela understood, that Catherine hadn't already recognized the signs of her condition, but Angela stopped herself nonetheless.
"I can't stop thinking about them," she finally said.
"Why?"
"It's hard to explain. When my mind gets focused on something, it's hard for me to let it go. So I started collecting information about the girls, and I think I found something."
Angela spread the information across the table. She had printed articles from newspapers and microfilm at the library, as well as pages from the books she had referenced and her own notes that filled the first third of her spiral notebook.
"Five girls have gone missing since spring. Here are the dates each disappeared."
Angela pointed to a different page.
"Here is a list describing each victim. Age, race, ethnicity, occupation, and physical characteristics, like hair color, skin tone, eye color. You get the idea."
Angela pushed the handwritten list to Catherine.
"The police say each disappearance is random. They believe the same man has taken all of these women, but they believe there is no connection between each woman. From what I can tell, they're right about that. The women, in relation to one another, have no association. But the police say the thief strikes unsystematically. That's not true."
Catherine looked at Angela.
"How long have you been working on this?"
"All summer. Since the women started to go missing. It's all I do, really. All I've been able to think about. But in reality, I realized this morning that I've been working on it much longer than just the summer. I just wasn't aware of it until now, until I put it together."
"What did you put together?"
Angela lifted a random sheet of paper from within the scattered Xeroxed pages.
"Look at this. I categorized all the characteristics of each missing girl, age, race, occupation, physical qualities, all the things on that list you're looking at. And then I went back to look not just at missing persons cases, but also homicides in and around Chicago that involved women who matched those characteristics."
Angela produced the handmade chart she had created at the library.
"Look here." She pointed at the graph paper. "On the bottom of my graph are years starting in 1960 and going all the way through to today, the summer of 1979.
Angela ran her finger from left to right across the bottom of the page. "On the vertical axis is the number of homicides of women who fall into the category of these missing women. Again, age, sex, race, physical characteristics. Now look, from 1960 to 1970, the number of homicides that involved women who matched these descriptions was flat." On the graph, a horizontal line ran from 1960 to 1970, without any substantial spikes or dips.
"But in 1970, Angela said, there was a sudden uptick in homicides involving these types of women."
On the chart, Angela's handwritten lines spiked upward dramatically in 1970.
"These are all the homicides in Chicago?" Catherine asked.
"No. In 1970, there were more than 800 homicides in and around Chicago. This graph only represents homicides involving women who match the characteristics of the five women who have gone missing this summer." Angela tapped the page again, tracing her finger over her graph. "The increase in homicides begins in 1970 and continues until 1972, then tapers out but stays high relative to the entire decade of the 1960s. Then, this year, 1979, there is a sudden drop again back to levels equal to the 60s. Catherine was nodding her head as she listened.
"I see the increase and the decrease. But what does it mean?"
Here's my theory, Angela said. The same person who was taking women this summer has been killing these types of women since around 1970. Between 1970 and 1978, he was careless and brazen. But since the beginning of this year, he's been more diligent. Instead of the police finding a body some weeks after a girl goes missing, now the women just disappear, with no bodies being discovered. Catherine squinted her eyes as she began to see Angela's theory come together. You're saying this person's reign of terror spans not just to this summer, but for the entire decade? Angela made eye contact again, her second time. Yes. Catherine sat back in her chair. This is some crazy stuff you're telling me. But you see how it's possible, right? Angela asked. When you present it to me this way, yes. That's assuming all your facts are correct. They are. And you got all this information from the library? It's all there for anyone.